The break's over. Anybody here? Hey, you're still here listening. This is Chuck Coughlin, Setting the Record Straight on Breadbox Media. We're talking about the Knowledge Network, the Catholic Church.
In Western Europe, you might call it Christendom, you might call it Catholicdom, but that's what we're reflecting on. I do like the term Catholicdom. It's descriptive. We're taking the years, we're taking the three centuries, 1000 to 1300, and we've been reflecting on the schools, the formation of schools. Rome had had plenty of schools, but many of those disappeared with the fall of Rome in the 400s. And it was up to the Catholic Church to recreate them, to recreate an educational system, just as they recreated the medical system and all sorts of social safety nets. They did that and went far better.
In England, the Cathedral School of York was famous. The School of Canterbury became almost a university, with an abundant library, and no less a man as secretary than John of Salisbury, one of the sanest scholars and philosophers of the Middle Ages. Of course, these people were all Catholic at this time. This is a long time before the Reformation, and England was thoroughly Roman Catholic.
You can take the example of Oxford. Oxford has a long history. This is the 21st century.
At this time, Oxford has been a Roman Catholic institution longer in its history than it has been a Protestant one. The church devoted a lot of funds to education. Students who were preparing for the priesthood were supported by cathedral funds. Others paid a modest fee. The Third Lateran Council decreed that, quote, in order that the opportunity of reading and making progress may not be taken away from the poor children, let some sufficient benefits be assigned in every cathedral church for a master who shall teach for free the clerks of the same church and poor scholars. And once again, to answer the charge that the Catholic Church didn't promote the Bible, first of all, you have to promote literacy. If you're illiterate, you can't read. And they did this more superbly, and the Catholic Church promoted literacy on a scale that was unprecedented. The next Lateran Council, the Fourth, required the establishment of a chair of grammar in every cathedral of the Christian world, and also chairs of philosophy and canon law. Pope Gregory IX, this is in the 1200s, directed every parish church to organize a school of elementary instruction. I wish they'd do it now. And recent researches indicate that such parochial schools,
chiefly devoted to religious instruction,
were very common throughout the Catholic world. What proportion of the children got to go to school? Of girls, apparently only the well-to-do. Most convents maintained schools for girls, but they probably reached only a modest percentage of girls. But some cathedral schools did admit girls, but they were women of noble birth. Boys had a better chance, but it was presumably difficult for the son of a serf to get an education. However, we hear of serfs who managed to get sons into Oxford. Much that is now taught in schools was then learned at home, a lot of the basic math and literacy.
Also through apprenticeships to various trades.
The number of boys in elementary schools in England in 1530 was probably around 26,000, and an estimated population of 5 million. Normally, a cathedral school was directed by a canon of the cathedral chapter. The teachers were clerks in minor orders. All instruction was in Latin.
Yes, Latin, the great white language.
Discipline was severe. The curriculum began with the trivium, three things, grammar, rhetoric, and logic, and passed to the quadrivium, arithmetic, geometry, music, astronomy. These were the, quote, seven liberal arts, the three of the trivium and the four of the quadrivium. But we wouldn't define those terms quite with their modern meaning. Trivium, of course, meant three ways. Liberal arts were those that Aristotle had defined as the proper subjects for free men who sought skills that weren't practical, but intellectual. So, for example, the study of medicine or architecture was considered too practical to be included in the strictly academic world. Grammar was not the dull study that loses the soul of language in studying its bones.
No, it wasn't done through dissection, but as an organic whole, as a flow.
It was the art of writing. It was a study of great poetry and oratory, as would enable one to write with correctness and elegance. It strikes us that logic seems a rather advanced subject for the trivium, the lower grades, but perhaps it was good that students should learn to reason as early as they learned to argue.
As we come to the end of our 300-year period, arbitrarily selected, we're getting close to 1300, there was a movement to create more and more secular schools,
and they were especially numerous in Italy.
Teachers there were usually laymen, and not the religious or clerics.
In general, the spirit and culture of Italy was less ecclesiastical than elsewhere. In Italy, the famous school of law was the University of Bologna. It was here that by the time of Aeneas, there was a rising demand for legal and commercial knowledge. These worked together to give Italy the honor of establishing the first medieval university. The University of Pavia is about to celebrate its 1200th anniversary of its foundation by Lothair I. This was probably a school of law rather than a university. It was one of the many schools that, from the 9th century onward, revived the study of Roman law. A famous scholar, Aeneas, began to teach law at Bologna in 1088. Whether his studies of Roman law convinced him of the historical and practical arguments for the supremacy of the imperial over the ecclesiastical power, or whether the rewards of imperial service attracted him, he interpreted the revived jurisprudence to favor imperial claims. So appreciative emperors contributed funds to the school, and a swarm of German students came down to Bologna. Aeneas composed a volume of comments on the laws of Justinian and applied the scientific method to the organization of law. His work on this is a masterpiece of exposition and argument. And this began the golden age of medieval jurisprudence. Men from every country in Latin Europe came to Bologna to learn the rejuvenated science of the law.
Aeneas had a pupil that has become renowned in history, Gracian.
Gracian applied the new methods to the ecclesiastical legislation and published the first code of canon law in 1139. This was the foundation of international law.
Laws that were uniform across the boundaries of countries.
Using these standard laws as an authority, kings and communes broke the sway of feudal law and fought the power of the popes. The papacy did what it could to halt this revival of a code that made religion a function and servant of the state. But the new study fed and expressed the bold rationalism and secularization of the 12th and 13th centuries, and raised a proliferating class of lawyers who labored to reduce the role of the church in government and to extend the authority of the state. St. Bernard complained that the courts of Europe rang with the laws of Justinian and no longer heard the laws of God.
But let's talk about the students. The students had guilds. They formed student guilds.
The student guilds originated to provide mutual protection and self-government. Came in the 13th century to exercise extraordinary power over the teaching staffs. They organized boycotts of unsatisfactory teachers. In many cases, the salaries of the professors were paid by the student universities, so-called, and the professors were compelled to swear allegiance to the guilds. A teacher who wanted a leave of absence had to obtain permission from his students. So by the 13th century, at the University of Bologna, there was a spirit, a lay spirit, almost an anti-clericalism, which was not found in other centers of European education. In these other centers, the chief faculty was theology. At Bologna, no theological faculty at all before 1364. Theology there was replaced by Gratian's canon law. It was a common saying that the most realistic education obtainable was to be had in Bologna. There was a story of how a Parisian teacher unlearned at Bologna what he'd taught at Paris, and then came back to Paris and untaught it. Bologna led the movement of the European mind, allowing its teaching staff to stiffen into a stagnant scholasticism of law. So what was going on in Spain? The University of Spain's were unique in being founded and chartered by the kings, serving them and submitting to governmental control. Despite this royal connection, the Spanish universities accepted ecclesiastical supervision and funds, and they grew out of cathedral schools in some cases. The famous University of Salamanca was richly endowed by San Fernando and Alfonso the Wise, and stood on equal footing with Bologna and Paris. But the unquestioned leader of the European mind in the medieval times was France. Its cathedral schools had achieved international renown from the 11th century on. The University of Paris flowered into a great university.
It was probably because of the thriving commerce on the Seine and the business of a capital city that brought the wealth that lures the intellect and finances, science, philosophy, and the arts. The first known master of the Cathedral School of Notre Dame was William of Champeau. It was his lectures given in the cloister of Notre Dame that stirred up the intellectual movement out of which the University of Paris grew. So it grew out of the cathedral school at Chartres. Abelard came out of Brittany and began the most famous lectures in French history. Students flocked to hear him. The schools of Paris swelled their ranks, and the masters multiplied. And as the masters multiplied, they formed their own guild. The word universitas had for centuries been applied to any collectivity, including guilds. You could call it a fellowship of the elected masters.
Well, here at BreadboxMedia.com,
it's time for Setting the Record Straight to take a break. And why don't you take a break, too?
On BreadboxMedia.com, this is Chuck Coughlin, Setting the Record Straight.
How are you doing today? One of the bits of misinformation that needs to be straightened out is a rather strange accusation, is that the Catholic Church kept the Bible away from the common people and didn't let them have access to the Bible. This needs to be set straight. You have to have a much larger picture than a few incidences. For instance, the Albigensians got hold of the Bible and modified it to such an extent that it became heretical, even contrary to Christ's teachings. This is a tiny incident compared to the vast panorama of the campaign of the Catholic Church over the last 2,000 years to spread the gospel in whatever way they could. First of all, if you're going to read the Bible, you have to be literate. And the Catholic Church has done more to spread the art of literacy than any other institution or entity in world history. They established a vast number of schools for this purpose. And what did they teach them to read in these schools that the Catholics had? They taught them to read Bible verses. Then they taught them to copy Bible verses. They may not have had a complete Bible because they were very expensive, on the order of $20,000 in today's terms. But they copied out portions of it. A complete Bible was available in the large churches. They could attend Mass, where they could hear large sections of the Bible read. The first printed Bible was by the Catholic Gutenberg, and it was the Vulgate Bible, the Catholic Bible. Who created the Bible? Well, as a book, St. Jerome and his project with the assistance of three women created the Bible. In the 300s, under a commission from the Pope. Why would they do that if they wanted to keep the Bible away from people? They translated it into Latin, the vulgar tongue, meaning the common tongue. Because in Western Europe, the common man spoke Latin everywhere. It was the great white language. So let's talk a little bit about the transmission of the Bible and the transmission of all knowledge as it occurred in Western Europe. Let's take the years 1000 to 1300, because you can't cover it all. It's a vast picture of a long campaign to make people literate enough to read the Bible and to supply them with Bibles. Authentic Bibles, not altered Bibles. The first translations into languages like German and English were done by Catholics. If a Bible contained heresies, it might have been suppressed. We're talking about the Bible translations approved by Rome. Those were widespread. Let's put our time travel boots on We're going to cover a period of about 300 years, starting about year 1000.
Let's start out by giving praise where praise is due. Praise is due to the great white language, Latin.
Latin. The joined Greek is of vast importance and an international language.
Understood far and wide across national boundaries. In the area known as Christendom.
It's interesting that just as the Church had preserved in some measure the political unity of Western Europe that the Roman Empire had achieved, so her ritual, her sermons, and her schools, especially her schools, maintained a Roman heritage now lost. Remember, this is the year 1000. The empire's gone. This is supposed to be the medieval times, the Dark Age, although it was far from dark. And what the schools were maintaining of the Roman heritage was an international language, intelligible to all the literate population of Italy, Spain, France, England,
Scandinavia,
the Lowlands, Germany, Poland, Hungary, and the Western Balkans. Educated men in these countries used Latin for correspondence, business records, diplomacy, law, government, science, philosophy, and nearly all the literature in Europe before the 13th century. They spoke Latin as a living language, which almost daily developed a new word or phrase to denote the new or changing realities or ideas of their lives. They wrote their love letters in Latin, from the simple to the most complex. A book was written not for a nation, but for the continent. It needed no translation, and was passed from country to country with a speed and freedom that's unknown today. Students went from one university to another with no thought of linguistic embarrassment. Scholars could lecture in the same language at Bologna, Salamanca, Paris, Oxford, Uppsala, and Cologne. Of course, they didn't hesitate to import new words into Latin, sometimes to the horror of the traditional ear. So Magna Carta ruled that no free man should be imprisonatist. Such words make us wince, but they kept Latin alive. Many modern English terms, for instance, substantive, essence, entity, descended from medieval additions to the Latin tongue. So it was a living language at that time. Of course, it wasn't all that simple, was it? There was some disruption of international intercourse caused by the collapse of the Roman Empire. And the poverty that did exist in the so-called Dark Ages made introverts of local areas. There was a decay of roads and a corresponding decline of commerce. Such segregation did create variations in language. The abdication of literature had left the field to the vocabulary and sentence structure of the common man, which had always been different from those of the poets and the orators. The influx of Germans, Gauls, Greeks, and Asiatics into Italy
brought in a huge variety of pronunciations,
made imprecise all the inflections and terminations of careful speech. The H became silent in Latin Latin. V, which used to be pronounced like the English W, acquired the sound of the English
V, as in Victor. When I attended Latin school as a beginner, I learned this about Latin. There was a very famous quote of Julius Caesar, "I came, I saw, I conquered."
Veni, vidi, vici was actually pronounced Veni, vidi, vici.
Sounds pretty lame, eh? Sounds like Elmer Fudd.
Veni, vidi, vici. There's a long list of these things. Final consonants began to be slurred and forgotten. Portus, porto, porte. Rex, re, wa. Case endings had to be replaced by prepositions. Conjugal endings by auxiliary verbs. The Latin unus, one, was shortened to form the indefinite article, un. Declensions disappeared, and it became difficult to tell whether a noun was the subject before or the object after the predicate. Viewing this continuous process of change over 20 centuries, we may think of Latin as the still-living and literary language of Italy, France, and Spain. No more transformed from the speech of Cicero than his from that of Romulus. It was widespread. 200 years before Christ, Spain began to speak Latin. By Cicero's time, the Spanish dialect had diverged so far from the usage in Rome, Cicero was shocked by what seemed to him to be barbaric pronunciations.
and Spain had an effect of softening the Latin consonants. T became D, P became B, K into G. Example, totem into toto.
Ecclesia into Iglesia.
North and South France developed their different dialects. And it was a medieval custom to differentiate dialects by their way of saying yes. Southeastern France had a dialect called Provençal. It actually became a polished literary language, rather elegant, in the hands of the troubadours. Back in Italy, the common tongue was formed more slowly than in Spain or France.
Latin was Italy's native speech.
The clergy spoke Latin, and they were especially numerous in Italy, and her schools kept the language from changing so freely as in lands with broken traditions. Truly, Latin was Italy's native speech. The language known as Italian hardly existed as a language at the beginning of the 13th century. There were merely some 14 dialects, continued and variously corrupt from the ancient language of the marketplace, each barely intelligible to the rest, and cherishing its differences with a passionate separateness, sometimes different quarters of the same city. In Bologna, there were several distinct dialects. The predecessors of Dante, Italy before Dante, those people had to create a language as well as a literature. Dante, in a pleasant fancy, thought that the Tuscan troubadours chose Italian as their medium because they wrote of love, and the ladies they addressed might not understand Latin. So, about 1300, Dante hesitated between the Latin and the Tuscan dialects as the language to use in the Divine Comedy. In the opinion of some scholars, Dante
created the Italian language,
gave it of a formality and disciplined grammar that is the language we know today. So while Latin was dividing reproductively into the Romance languages, Old German was splitting into Middle German, Frisian, Dutch, Flemish, English, Danish, Swedish, Norwegian, and even Icelandic. Old German is merely a convenient phrase to indicate the many dialects that exercised their tribal sovereignty before the year 1000. Monks from Ireland, England, and France and Italy labored to invent terms to translate Latin. Sometimes they appropriated Latin words bodily into German. Kaiser, prince, legend. This was a legitimate theft. Tragic, however, was the influence of Latin sentence structure, keeping the verb to the end, and changing the once simple syntax of the German people into the stiff, inverted
language of later German.
The Teutonic speech of the Anglo-Saxons in youth went with them to England in the 5th century and lay down the foundations of the English language, gave it almost all of its short and racy words. French flooded the land with the Normans and ruled the court and the aristocracies for about 300 years after the year 1066, while Latin continued to preside over religion and education, actually until around 1730s, and it was the language of official documents. Thousands of French words entered into English, especially in areas like cookery, law, costumes, mode of dress. Half the terminology of English law is French.
Time for a little break. We'll be back, Chuck Coughlin, on Setting the Record Straight.
On BreadboxMedia.com, this is Chuck Coughlin back with Setting the Record Straight, this time about the Catholic Church, which is the greatest knowledge network the world has ever known. And we're going to talk about that a little more now.
Today we're reflecting on language.
And we've confined ourselves to the 300 years between 1000 and 1300 AD, when the English owned a good bit of France, the Norman area.
For three centuries, the literatures of France and England were one, and as late as Chaucer, the spirit and language of English letters were half French. When the French domination passed, the English language was immeasurably enriched by adding French and Latin to its German base. English could triply express any one of 1,000 ideas. Words like kingly, royal, regal, twofold, double, duplex, daily, journal, diurnal. To this it owes its wealth of discriminating synonyms and verbal nuances. Well, what about in the world of books? How were all these diverse languages written? After the fall of Rome in 476, the conquering barbarians adapted the Latin alphabet and wrote it with the cursive or running hand that bound the letters together and gave most of them a curved form instead of the straight lines that had been found convenient in writing upon hard surfaces like stone or wood. The Catholic Church preferred in those centuries a large letter writing, majuscule it was called, to facilitate the reading of missals and books of the hours. In Charlemagne's time, when they copied books, preserving Latin literature, they made many copies of the classics. They saved costly parchment by adopting a minuscule or small letter writing. We often refer to this script writing as writing in longhand. So we have majuscule, which is large letter writing, and minuscule. Minuscule was for the purpose, sort of cramped looking, was for the purpose of saving the costly parchment. Of course, they would reuse the parchment sometimes. That's what's interesting. Many times parchments were scraped to erase an old manuscript and receive a second composition. There's a word for that, palimpsest, the palimpsest. Old works were lost by such erasures, by misplacement of manuscripts, by war, pillage, fire, decay. The Huns sacked the monastic libraries in Bavaria, Northmen in France, Saracens in Italy. Saracens are Muslims. And many Greek classics were lost forever in the plunder of Constantinople of 1204. There was an abundant heritage of classical literature that was preserved by the monks, by the copyists. But there were also professional scribes who were engaged by rich men or by booksellers or by monasteries. Their labor was wearisome. It was hard work. Sometimes they wrote little personal notes in the margins or at the bottom. One monk wrote, "This completes the whole. For Christ's sakes, give me a drink. Explicit hoc totum pro Christo da mihi potum." Now, the medieval church exercised no censorship over the publication of books. If a book proved both heretical and influential, like Abelard's On the Trinity, it might be denounced by a church council. But books were then too few to be any kind of a peril to orthodoxy. Even the Bible was rare outside of monasteries. A year was required to copy a Bible, a year's income of a parish priest to buy it. Few clergymen had a full copy. The New Testament and special books of the Old Testaments had a wider circulation. Bibles of great size, magnificently decorated, were produced in the 12th century. They could be handled only on a reading desk, usually in a monastic library. It might even be chained to the desk for better preservation. There were heretics even then. The Albigensians were doing
in their interpretations of the scripture, exhibited some pretty wild ideas and flights of fancy.
And of course the church came down on them.
But in general,
the church was not opposed to Bible reading on the part of the laity. That's a Protestant myth, actually. When you think about it, the church created the Bible. Jerome and the three women, Paula, Fabiola, and Eustochia, the daughter who had the wonderful hand for copying. And whoever did more to spread the cause of literacy in the entire history of the world than the Catholic Church. And what was that literacy primarily used for? Well, to read the Bible. If you didn't have the old Bible, you could copy pieces of it if you were literate. And that's what schoolboys did. Schoolboys in Inner Mongolia in the year 250 A.D. were copying phrases out of the Latin Bible. Same thing going on in England. Same year, 250. Earlier than had been thought before. Now, writing was done on parchment, papyrus, vellum, or paper with quill or reed pens using black or colored ink. Papyrus disappeared from common use in Europe after the Islamic conquest of Egypt. Vellum, which is prepared from the skin of young lambs, was expensive and was reserved for the luxurious manuscripts. Parchment was made from coarse sheepskin. That was the usual medium of medieval writing. Now, paper, that was a costly import from Islamic countries right up to the 12th century. But then, in 1190, paper mills were set up in Germany and France. And in the 13th century, Europe began to make paper from linen. Now, you may know this, but the size of a book and its pages were determined by the size of the available skins, each of which was folded to make a folio. After the 5th century, books were no longer issued in rolls or scrolls. The skins were cut in rectangular sizes to make 4, quarto, 8, octavo, 12, duodecimo, or 16, sextodecimo, sheets to one folio. The binding might be of heavy parchment cloth, leather, or even board. And of course, these were decorated. It's interesting that St. Jerome rebuked the Romans, said, "Your book are carved with precious stones, and Christ died naked." But books were a luxury. An ordinary volume, in today's term, would cost about $4,000 in our present currency. Bernard of Chartres, a man who led the revival of ancient classics in the 12th century, left a library of only 24 volumes. Italy was richer than France, and one famous man collected 63 books. So the cost of books delayed the rise of anything like a bookseller until the 12th century. Then the university town engaged men to organize corps of copyists to transcribe books for teachers and students, and these men sold copies to anybody that cared to pay for them. Nobody ever seemed to dream of paying a living author. If a man insisted on writing a new book, he had to pay its cost or find a king or a magnate to grace his palm for a dedication. He couldn't advertise his book except by word of mouth. He couldn't even publish it, make it public, except by getting it used in a school or having it recited before whatever audience he could collect. The cost of books and the dearth of funds,
in effect, produced a rate of illiteracy
which would have been shameful to ancient Greece. Now, Rome had a literacy rate of about 10%. Rome had about 75 million inhabitants. So that meant about 7.5 million people in the Roman Empire were literate. And of course, these people performed key functions for everybody else. And of course, the business classes must have been literate because we still have the elaborate accounts they kept. Books were carefully exchanged from family to family, monastery to monastery, and country to country. Libraries, though small, were numerous. Saint Benedict ruled that every Benedictine monastery should have a library. Many cathedrals, Toledo, Barcelona, Bamberg, Hildesheim, had substantial libraries. As to this, Canterbury had 5,000 books in 1300. That's quite exceptional. Most libraries had less than 100. The papal library began with Pope Damascus around 366. Its precious manuscripts and archives were mostly lost in the turmoil of the 13th century. The present Vatican library dates from the 15th century. And of course, there were private libraries.
And then we come to a very central subject in that, which is the schools. The institutions of learning. Culture is transmitted from generation to generation in the years 1000 to 1300. Was, first of all, undertaken by the family, the church, and then the school. In the Middle Ages, moral education was stressed at the expense of intellectual enlightenment. Just as today, intellectual education is stressed at the expense of moral discipline. In England, it was not unusual in the middle and upper classes to send a boy of 7 to be brought up for a time in another home, partly to cement family friendships. The splendid school system of the Roman Empire had decayed in the tumult of invasion and the depopulation of the towns.
When the tidal wave of migration subsided in the 6th century, a few lay schools survived in Italy. The rest were mostly schools for training converts and prospective priests. Under the prodding of Charlemagne, cathedrals, monasteries, parish churches, and convents opened schools for the general education of boys and girls. At first, the monastic schools bore nearly all this burden. There was a scola interior that was, of course, provided instructions for novices, and a scola exterior offered education to boys apparently without charge. In Germany, these monastic schools survived the disorders of the 9th century and shared productively in the Ottonian Renaissance. I think you know about King Otto the First and Second, who centered himself in Reichenau. Under those two kings, there was one of the great 7 renaissances. That was called the Ottonian Renaissance. It occurred in the 9th and 10th centuries. At that time, Germany led France in the graces of the mind. In France, the disintegration of the Carolinian house and the raids of the Northmen struck cruel blows at the monastic schools. The palace school that Charlemagne had established at the Frank Court didn't live long.
Before the break, I want to read a poem I just came across. E. E. Cummings.
I thank you, God, for this most amazing day.
for the leaping greenly spirits of trees, and a blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, and which is, yes, I who have died am alive again today. And this is the sun's birthday, and this is the birthday of life and love and wings, and of the gay great happenings, illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing any, lifted from the know of all nothing, human merely being, doubt unimaginable you? Now the ears of my eyes awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are open. What a wonderfully religious poem. Of course, the unimaginable you is God. It's a capital Y. This is Chuck Coughlin on BreadboxMedia.com, setting the record straight.
This is Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight. We're talking about the transmission of knowledge and the growth of the university movement in Western Europe in Catholicdom. After the fall of the Roman Empire, the rate of illiteracy and the uneducated rose. But what is usually called the Dark Age was actually the beginning of an intellectual ferment that culminated in some of the greatest universities in the world.
It became the knowledge network.
So let's get back to our story. We were talking about the fellowship of students, the guilds, the fellowship of the teachers. They had guilds also. We culminated in saying the university was now a fellowship of the elect masters. Scholars assume, but we cannot prove, that the university as such took form around 1170, sort of as a guild of teachers rather than as a union of faculties. Around 1210, a bull of Pope Innocent III, himself a graduate of the University of Paris, recognized and approved the written statutes of this teacher's guild, and another bull of the same pope empowered the guild to choose a proctor to represent it at the papal court. There was no special university buildings. Lectures were given in the cloisters of Notre Dame, Saint-Geneviève, Saint-Victor, and other ecclesiastical structures. But in the 13th century, we find teachers hiring private rooms for their classes. The masters came to be called also professores, proclaimers, professores. They were tonsured clerics who, before the 15th century, lost their position if they married. Teaching was by lecture, largely for the reason that not every student could afford to buy all the texts and could not always secure copies from the libraries. The students sat on the pavement or on the floor and took many notes. The burden on their memories was so severe that many mnemonic devices were contrived. University regulations forbade the teacher to read his lecture, and he was required to speak extemporaneously. There were no teleprompters in those days. The whole process was livened up when they had public disputations among the masters, advanced students, and distinguished visitors. Usually, the debate followed a set form, the scholastica disputatio. The question was stated, a negative answer was given, and was defended by scriptural and patristic quotations, and by reasoning in the form of objections. A positive answer followed, defended by quotations from the Bibles and the Fathers of the Church, and by reasoned replies to the objections. The body, called the Scholastica Disputatio, determined the finished form of the scholastic philosophy. In addition to such formal sessions, there were informal discussions, called Quod Libeta, whatever you please. These debates sharpened the medieval mind and gave scope for much freedom of thought and speech. Most of the students lived in guest houses hired by organized student groups. Sometimes a hospital would board poor students for a very small fee. So the famous Hotel Dieu, adjoining Notre Dame, set aside room for poor clerks, as they were called. Groups of students called themselves colleges. Further colleges, or collegia, in the old sense of associations, were founded. Masters came to live in them, serve as tutors, heard recitations, and read texts with the students. Finally, in the 15th century, the masters gave courses in the residence halls. Such courses increased in numbers. Courses given outside decreased, and the college,
became a hall of education, as well as a dwelling place. A similar evolution of the college occurred at Oxford. So there we have it. The university began as an association of teachers dealing with associations of students and became an association of faculties and colleges. No educational organization or institution since Aristotle has rivaled the influence of the University of Paris. For three centuries, it drew to itself not only the largest number of students, but the greatest dynasty of intellectually distinguished men, Abelard, John of Salisbury, Albertus Magnus, Albert the Great, Sigurd of Brabant, Thomas Aquinas, Bonaventura, Roger Bacon, Duns Scotus, William of Ockham. This parade of men is almost the history of philosophy from 1100 to 1400. There must have been great teachers at Paris to produce these greater ones, and an atmosphere of mental exhilaration that comes only to the peaks of human history. Furthermore, through those centuries, the University of Paris was a power both in church and state. It was an influential organ of opinion. In the 14th century, a hotbed of free speculation. In the 15th century, a citadel of orthodoxy and conservatism. The most renowned of the French universities outside of Paris was at Montpellier, situated on the Mediterranean, halfway between Marseille and Spain. The city was a mixture of French, Greek, Spanish, and Jewish blood and culture, sprinkling of Italian merchants, and even some remnants of the Moorish colonies that had once held the town. Let's go across the strait to England. Oxford, like the equivalently named Bosphorus, developed as a cattle crossing, the Oxford. The Thames narrowed and grew shallower at that point. A fortress was built there in 912, a market formed, and King Canute and Harold held sway there long before the university arose. Presumably there were schools at Oxford and King Canute's stay, but we hear of no cathedral school. By steps now lost to history, the schools of Oxford became in the 12th century a university. No man can say when. In 1209, there were about 3,000 students and teachers at Oxford. At Paris, there were four faculties, arts, theology, medicine, and canon law. In England, the teaching of civil law escaped the universities and lodged at the Inns of Court in London, Lincoln's Inn, Gray's Inn. The Inner and the Middle Temple were the 14th century descendants of the homes or chambers in which judges and teachers of the law in the 12th and 13th century received students as apprentices. So, just like in Paris, at Oxford the colleges began as endowed residence halls for poor students. And in a similar way, at an early date, they also became lecture halls. Masters dwelt in them with the students. And by the end of the 13th century, the halls had become the physical and pedagogical constituents of the university. In general, the English colonies grew wealthy not only by fellowship grants and other gifts, but through the rise in values of the estates with which they were endowed. By 1300, Oxford ranked next to Paris as a center of intellectual activity and influence. Its most famous graduate was Roger Bacon. Other Franciscan monks, including Adam March, Thomas of York, John Peckham, formed with him there a distinguished group of learned men. One interesting thing is that the medieval student might be of any age. He could be a curate, a prior, an abbot, a merchant, a married man. He might be a lad of 13. He went to Bologna, Orleans, or Montpellier to become a lawyer or a physician, or to other universities. He went, in some cases, to prepare for governmental service, and very often to make a career in the church. Arriving at one of these towns, he would find himself one of a large crowd of happy, embarrassed, and eager students riding on a wave of intellectual enthusiasm that made philosophy as exciting as war and a debate as fascinating and as a tournament. At Paris, he would have found in 1300 7,000 students, at Bologna 6,000, and at Oxford 3,000.
He didn't have to dress in a particular way.
However, he was requested to button his robe and not go shoeless unless his robe reached to his heels. As the water was hardly safe to drink, and neither tea nor coffee nor tobacco had yet reached Europe, the students reconciled themselves with wine and beer to Aristotle and heatless room. Whereas Oxford is a manufacturing center today, as well as a university, Cambridge is still a city of colleges, a medieval jewel, brightened with modern wealth and British good taste. Everything in it pertains to its colleges, and the medieval peace of mind survives in this loveliest of university towns. Apparently, its intellectual eminence has to be dated from a murder at Oxford. In 1209,
a woman was murdered in Oxford. In Oxford.
By a student. The townspeople raided a residence hall and hung two or three students.
Well, this certainly went well beyond the usual town and gown controversy.
The university, the Association of Masters, suspended operations in protest against the action of the townsfolks. And if we may believe the usually trustworthy Matthew Paris, 3,000 students and presumably many masters left Oxford. A lot of them, we are told, went to Cambridge and set up halls and faculties. This is the first mention we have of anything higher there than an elementary school. There was a second migration from Paris, 1228. Parisian students swelled the ranks of the student body. Monks, mendicant or Benedictine, came and established colleges. In 1281, the Bishop of Ely organized the first secular college in Cambridge, St. Peter's College, now called Peterhouse. The 14th, 15th, 16th century saw the foundation and embellishment of additional colleges. Some of them are masterpieces of medieval architecture. All of them together, embraced by the quiet winding Kame, constitute with their campuses one of the fairest works of man.
So we take leave of our reflections upon the transmission of knowledge from generation to generation in Western Europe. This has been Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin.
So it is true, the Knowledge Network is the Catholic Church.